This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we take somebody's favourite freak of nature, animal, monster, terror of the deep, and break them down and see how they might work in the real world by looking at their physiology and their ecology. This week we are looking at the Graboids from the Tremors franchise. But before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I run natureaccordingtosam.com. I am an ecology PhD student at the University of Norwegian Science and Technology. With me today is a fellow PhD student and fellow author at Ecology for the Masses, or ecomass.wordpress.com, Adam Harchek. Last but not least is Dave, our vet mate from Canada, who looks at animal physiology for us. Not with us today, once more, is TJ, our American friend, also a vet operating in Canada. TJ this week, I believe, is down denutering elephants at the zoos in Bolivia.
Yeah. Denutering.
Anyway.
Animal genitalia is a specialty.
Yeah, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Not bad. Nice early start for the pod today.
Yeah, very well early for you guys. 3 o'clock for me. We're going to have to switch soon. I'm going to be in Australia in 3 weeks' time, and then it's going to throw us all through a fucking loop.
Yeah, you'll basically be like 7 hours behind me, but on the other side of the day calendar.
Dave, you got any interesting animal-related news coming out of Canada?
Any feral beaver attacks?
No feral beaver attacks as of yet.
Interviewed a reef biologist last week, Sean Connolly, from the University of James Cook.
Yeah.
In Townsville in Australia. Really really well-renowned university in terms of reef biology, that sort of thing. Spoke to him about the mass bleaching events that have happened in the past couple of years. So for those who don't know, when the temperature goes above, Sean was saying the threshold is about 1 degree over the normal summer maximum. You get the algae or the plants which inhabit the coral being an animal, being expelled, and the coral then loses everything that gives it its pigmentation, and that's when bleaching occurs. And they just had mass events, one worldwide in 2016, and then one in 2017, which just really affected the Great Barrier Reef quite severely. And now I think about 2/3 of the reef is just gone. Like the corals are just dead at the moment. Had mass mortality because everything was expelled for too long. And even a couple of times they've had events where, like, it's not even a matter of the coral starving to death because the plants aren't in there for that symbiotic relationship. Sometimes in the last couple of years the corals have just flat out died from heat stress. So yeah, it's going to be, you know, kissing goodbye to the biggest barrier reef in the entire world quite soon, I think.
Yeah, nobody knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, the good thing is that climate change is only a Chinese myth, so we're good.
Oh. Yeah, it's conspiracy, right? Run by the Chinese. I mean, I trust Donald.
Oh, that makes me feel a lot better. I was really worried. Okay.
Woo!
Yeah. What about you, Adam? Got any news for us?
No, we just got some people coming through the department this week, so it's been real hectic in that we've had... So usually if we have a seminar speaker, especially an invited speaker by the graduate students, they speak on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. We'll have like a little lunch with them. Sometimes some of the students will take them out for dinner, especially if it's a really cool scientist you really want to spend some time talking to. Like when Andrew Hendry came here, I went with him, took him out to dinner with some of the fellow ecologists, and it was just a great time.
Yeah.
But because it's a interview for a faculty position, there are like 4 or 5 different seminars, and we have to have lunch with every single one of them, or we're supposed to have lunch with every single one of them so that we can get a sense of how they are, how they interact with the department. Yeah. So it's a lot of time away from work that I should be doing, and it's stuff that needs to be done, you know, to kind of help this whole process with academia, but yeah, it's a bummer sometimes.
Only so many shoulders you can rub before it starts getting to the point of chafing. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Plenty of chafage.
Oh yeah.
That's what I like. Graboid. That's it. Graboid.
Jesus, Walter.
Gonna be sorry, don't give it a name.
All right, well then, look, let's dive into it. As we said earlier, we...
I see what you did there.
Dive in. Graboid, Tremors, diving into the soil.
Yeah.
Let's dive into Adam's soiled underwear and have a look at the...
You don't want to do that.
No, you don't want to do that. Anyway, like I said, this week we're doing the Graboids from the Tremors franchise. Now, as always, we're going to have a look at the history of the movies. An enormous franchise this week, so Dave's got a fair bit to get through. And then after that, we'll, you know, talk a little bit about what we thought of the movie, that sort of thing, whether it's worth watching for you guys to chuck it on, which this week I cannot recommend enough. And then Dave will get Dave, as our resident vet, will get into the physiology of them. And then Adam and I will dive into their ecology. I've got to stop saying dive into. I need a better word. In any case, I will put timestamps in the description down below. So if you want to skip to any particular point, if you don't care about the movies and just want to know how a giant worm would terrorize the Great Plains of America, you're welcome to do that. But in the meantime, Dave,
desert.
Take us away. Tell us a bit about the Graboids and the Tremors franchise.
Sure. So the Tremors franchise, obviously, first sort of showed up in the 1990s with Tremors 1. The idea being a horror film coming out in the 1990s starring the ever-charismatic...
1990.
Yes, starring the ever-charismatic Kevin Bacon.
Horror being a very loose term again here.
Yes, yes. I mean, it is kind of funny to see them try to make that transition, but yes.
Yeah.
The Graboids sort of first appeared as these giant subterranean worms that came through the dirt and seemed capable of pulling down humans, sheep, cars, anything that kind of came into their way. First showing up in Perfection, Nevada. First showing up in Perfection, Nevada, being discovered attacking a couple of local ranches out in the desert, moving very quickly sort of through the loose dirt, and coming up to the characters quickly realizing they had no eyes, seemed to live underground with a hard beak, and these sort of prehensile arms that came out and sort of grabbed the characters. Regardless to say, Kevin Bacon and his friends teamed up, had a couple of good adventures, lost a couple of people in ways that you would think they would have been far more upset about people getting pulled down or eaten, but they seem to get over that pretty quick and
they,
go back to
they
their
do
normal
tend
style
to take it
humor.
In stride.
What are they taking in stride?
They just took the deaths in stride, all of them. It's just like, oh, he's dead.
Oh, he's dead. Yeah. The deaths actually seem to get more powerful as the movies go on. In terms of later films, the characters seem to get, like, more upset when they lose a member and they're more attached to him kind of thing.
Okay.
100%.
Yeah. No, I...
Although, granted, at least in the first one... A decent amount of the characters are these kind of people that wanted to live, you know, far from other people, kind of isolated. So they had this very solitary, rough, hard existence. So people dying this often and this terribly is definitely out of the ordinary, but people do die in places like that.
Hmm.
So I guess we can try to explain it away that way.
What are there, 14 people in that town?
14.
Yeah. Can we call that a town?
Yes!
Oh, yeah. Fine. We call that a town.
Sorry. I grew up in a city of 5 million people, okay? Whatever.
Ooh, must be nice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it was.
I grew up in Batmania.
The giant worms, about halfway through the film, because they grab on to things, are nicknamed the Graboids by a shop owner who is then shortly eaten afterward. A comment that is referenced throughout the series whenever they talk about who came up with the name. They quickly learn that they can sort of kill these monsters off, either by running them into concrete or attempting to use explosives to get them. And finally, after a harrowing journey to try and get out and get away from these things, which appear to be quite intelligent, they manage to finally kill off the last Graboid. Much celebration. Kevin Bacon sort of goes off.
So many rednecks just pumping their fist in the air,
right?
And going, woohoo,
right?
And yeehaw.
And
come on, do it some justice. They're going, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And Kevin Bacon finally working up the energy to ask the PhD out that's, frankly, outside of his league, but making the other PhDs watching or listening to this podcast feel really bad, because that's not how it works in the real world.
I love how in this movie, like, when they first introduce that female character, it's like Kevin Bacon's so disappointed because she's not that attractive. But she is very attractive.
She's gorgeous.
So what they do, they just put, like, one of those Legionnaire's caps and a smear of sunscreen on her nose to make
and
her look real dorky.
Her, they and just I'm change like, her hair color. They're just like, oh, she's a brunette, so sorry.
Yeah. Kevin Bacon's so disappointed. I'm like, ah, she's hot, man. Like, she's sunscreen on her nose. Chill out.
So after the first Tremors was a huge and potentially unexpected success.
But I mean, it in the realm of like, because it cost like how much to make? Like 11 million?
Mm-hmm.
11 million. I think it made like 16 million.
Yeah. 16 million. I mean, that's not a huge, like, that's not a huge amount. Like, I don't get why they made it a sequel, because I mean, it didn't make that much money at the box office. A lot of that 16 million will have been in sales since it first came out.
Right.
So yeah, it's a bit weird as to why they made a sequel.
Good point. I don't know.
Well, you have to remember that all of the other sequels were all direct to video, so there's definitely a much smaller budget going on there.
Yeah.
And it was all due to fans like myself that just really enjoyed them and would go out and make the effort to find the VHS at a Blockbuster. It was the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wonder how accurately, I mean, the thing is, it released to really incredible critical reception. And so it may just have been like...
Incredible?
I mean, like, the critics at the time were giving it for a horror franchise. I mean, it was getting something between, like, you know, 7 out of 10 and 85%. I mean, people liked it. They thought that it was an interesting mix of like horror and comedy in a way that really hadn't been, I mean, it had been done before, but just not quite in that way.
Yeah
the nice thing about those movies is it's all practical effects, at least for the first one, so it still looks pretty good.
Yeah,
almost 30 years later.
Yeah, the shriekers don't quite hold up as well.
Anyway, sorry. Keep chugging along.
The films ended up going on to 2, 3, 4, and 5. The second film, following along with not Kevin Bacon, but following along with his partner in crime, Earl Bassett. Fred Ward. His character ends up getting brought down to Mexico to try and deal with another strain of graboid, and to try and...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, to try and help take care of them, because they're attacking the local oil fields. He ends up getting embroiled in that entire scenario where they find out the second life cycle of the Shrieker. They think they've caught themselves a graboid, which ends up sort of bursting open, and from this giant worm comes these little bipedal creatures that run around with these sort of open mouths, seem to shriek at regular...
These stubby little butts.
Shriek at regular frequencies and track by infrared. And whenever they consume a large amount of food, as they discover they give birth to these basically little versions of themselves. So the second film ended up finishing with, you know, our Fred Ward and our Michael Gross, or Earl and Bert, defeating the worms with two other characters whose names I didn't memorize. And the entire thing going off in an explosion as they destroy the oil yard that they were, or the refinery they were supposed to be protecting, and set off to go get their money. And then the third film ended up introducing the concept of Adam's favorite creature, the Ass Blaster.
The Ass Blaster.
Which took us back to Perfection, Nevada, where the graboids at that point were thought to be completely extinct, where...
Also the name of the film.
Yeah. Oh, right. Back to Perfection.
And the second one's called Tremors 2, Aftershocks.
Tremors 2 being not a great film compared to Tremors 1, and Tremors 3 being a lot of fun, actually. Not quite, like, potentially my
That was my favorite
one. I'd say it's my second favorite in the series. I still love the first, but the third one is just, it's good, it's well done. There's nothing more fun than watching halfway through the film when they've discovered the worms are back in Perfection, Nevada, having the U.S. government show up and be like, these worms are a protected species. And it's like, yes, they would. They would, and I'm not against that. I think that's because I feel for the worms at many points. And then having, you know, of course, the ass blasters, the flying, I'm really glad we're not doing them from a physiology perspective. Monsters sort of coming to life, gliding, yep.
It's important.
They're blasting themselves into the air, flying around, their contribution to the life stage never being completely explained all the way through in terms of...
Yeah. I mean, well, don't they lay the eggs, safety. Right?
They lay the eggs, yes, and then they fly them the distance, but then why do you have the shriekers that are capable of giving birth to, like, brand new live young that can then run off and go to everything?
I'll talk about that in the reproduction, cool. The reproduction section.
We'll get stuck into that, yeah.
Okay, and, of course, ending with them killing all but the what they believe is the final worm that they nicknamed El Blanco, and the reason that they end up keeping him alive at the end, which becomes rather funny, is because they don't want either the U.S. government or... these realtors to come in and try to buy the property up. So as long as they keep a couple of worms alive, it means that theoretically they're in a area of endangered life. Ending with them leaving one of the most horrendous and terrible monsters of the franchise, Melvin, standing on a rock, unable to get to his SUV. And the fourth film taking place in the past. And do we want to talk about Tremors 5?
Do 5 and 6 very quickly.
I mean... Tremors 5. Was there a Tremors 6?
Cold Day in Hell?
Yeah, that was, this year.
Oh, right.
That came out this
year. I did not see Tremors 6. All right, Tremors...
It's on... Oh my god, it's on American Netflix. You gotta watch it. It's really good. It's really
and
good.
And Tremors 5 just being more of Bert, except sort of following him along as his survivalist character... fights more of the monsters. There's a little bit of sort of the ass blasters attacking and taking people, and there's more discussion for the paleontologist. Look, this one isn't good. I'm not going to get into Tremors 5.
Yeah. And then Cold Day in Hell is like somehow they're up in none of it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was leading up to that. I'm like, that is Sam's favorite line when he lived in Canada. It was every morning you'd try to get him up or something like that, and he'd be like, "Yeah, I'm having none of it."
Having none of it, mate. Yeah. All right. Well,
why did they let you in Canada?
Yeah. On to what we actually thought of these fucking films.
Broke into the wrong goddamn rec room, didn't you, you bastard?
They're great. they're fucking great.
They're so good.
I only watched the first one because I didn't want to, you know, get into a loop where I just, you know, I was watching Tremors film every night when I got home. I think I would have been murdered by my partner. But I'll tell you what, I am violently anti gun ownership. However, when I was watching the first Tremors film, I was like, nah, you know what America needs more of? Fucking guns, man.
See, when you watch those movies, you can understand why it's fun to just go out somewhere and just shoot guns in the air for no reason. Also, don't do that. It's really
bad. Yeah,
I know.
But these are movies that I remember. I always have memories of going to my friend's house when I was, you know, elementary school, middle school, like 10 year old and younger, and just going to Blockbuster, renting as many of these movies as we could find, just watching them over and over every weekend.
Nice.
And it was just
so
much fun. I love these movies.
Was rewatching the second Tremors, and I had forgotten that my dad and I had watched this, and it was one of our favorite scenes. Is they have this point where Bert is up against one of the shriekers, and he's got to try and take it out from a distance using his sniper rifle because it's kind of up against this concrete wall. And, you know, he lines up the shot, and the other characters cover their ears, and they've got to take out the shrieker before it sees them. And he fires, and he's got this bullet that he's been referring to as the anti-tank round will go through absolutely anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, it hits this poor shrieker that explodes into a mush of red and orange. And then they have this fantastic scene where they go over and, you know, the camera shot follows through the concrete wall which the bullet has passed through another concrete wall behind that, through like two more like steel drums, through like another piece of sheet metal, and then finally through the truck at the end, which is supposed to be their escape vehicle. And there's this great scene as it like pans out and we can see it's gone through the truck, and we're kind of left with the idea that, like, you know, that bullet is still going today. And it's just such a great scene for just seeing, like, as they walk over and this weapon has just gone through everything in its path, and it's like, yep, that's how the Americans build their guns.
Another thing I love about this movie is how, like, accurately they get the confusion of that PhD student. Because she's like, she's a geologist, right? Yeah. And they know she's a scientist. And they're always just asking like, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? Shit that has nothing to do with geology. And she's just like, what the fuck are you asking me for? I don't know this.
Why are you looking at me?
Yeah. It's like, because I get that all the time. A question will come up about some completely unrelated thing. Like, I don't know, climate change or like fucking bear hibernation. And I'll be like, what the fuck are you asking me for? I study fish.
You find the opposite in American universities where you have... I think the U.S. is one of the only places to have, like, pre-med as a major, where students are just, they're on a career course to eventually go to medical school. And as a result, they take a lot of courses that deal with, you know, medicine-related topics. But because of that, a lot of people that take these pre-med courses seem to think that they're now qualified to give medical advice. And so whenever something is wrong, they're like, I'm pre-med, so let me check this out, or you obviously have cancer. So, shut up.
Yeah.
Cuttlefish. Deep sea fish, they make lights, disco lights, to hypnotize their prey, and then, I saw a documentary, it was terrifying.
Alright, so, let's get into to the physiology of it then. Just to make it clear for the majority of this, especially for Dave, looking at the physiology, we've decided to base most of this off what we saw in Tremors 1.
Thank you.
Obviously, yeah, Adam and I are going to have to look at the life history, the life cycle and population dynamics later on. So we've gone a little in, we've taken some info from the other films. And what we've done, this week's a little different in that we have like some kind of biologists who have done some work in the movies on this sort of stuff, and they've given some kind of facts, and so we've tried to stick with that where possible. There's a couple of things in here. Ecologists, biologists, zoologists, I'm not sure.
The Sci-Fi Channel.
But there's some experts within these... Okay, well, there's some experts within the Sci-Fi Channel who have given some, you know, some facts on the graboids, and we've tried to stick with them wherever possible. We've had to make some concessions every now and then.
So, going forward in terms of the physiology section, we had all sort of watched the Sci-Fi Channel, and as Adam had sort of helpfully pointed out to me, We know that these creatures are supposed to be cephalopods, or at least that's
so the same kind of organism as an octopus or a squid,
right? Or which is going to work best for us in this scenario, a cuttlefish. And we know that they're supposed to be. Adam, you were saying 400 million years old.
Yeah, the original, the first film, the one that we are basing most of this off of, mentions them possibly. No, sorry, Tremors 2. They find a fossilized graboid spike. And they date it to the Precambrian, so about 600 million years old. The only problem with that is there is nothing around 600 million years ago that would be big enough to sustain organisms that are this large. So in the television series, which is around 2003, they kind of retconned it, and they're like, oh, that was a mistake. They're actually from the Devonian, and that was about 400 million years ago, which is a good time for them because there would have been food large enough.
So the sort of official statement from what seems to be released, they were placed at, as Adam was mentioning earlier, they can get as big as 9.1 meters long or 30 feet, and they can weigh around 20 tons, making them sort of the largest land mammal. They seem to be native to a couple of different locations, but for this film, we're just going to focus on them in Perfection, Nevada. And as discussed, they ended up sort of placing them in the cephalopod, grouping, so the same one as squids, mollusks, and cuttlefish. In terms of their physical features, they seem to have rigid spikes covering their body that get sort of tossed in at one point by one of the geologists who, for some reason, is just like, that must be how they move through the earth.
There's like 20 of them.
And then the spikes seem to somehow help them sense their surroundings. Their head appears to be sort of this tough, chitinous beak with these sort of big hooked mammals. They're reportedly completely blind. They have a severely limited habitat, and as everyone refers to, they've never been seen before, and there appears to be nothing about them in the fossil record.
But that does not make sense, the severely limited habitat thing.
No, and we'll get into that when we start to sort of talk about things. But they seem to clock in around 15 to 20 miles per hour when they're sort of moving along. And their main feature being this sort of cluster of three sort of tentacle-like appendages that sort of come out of the throat. And terminate in these prehensile mouths that seem to grab everything. So from watching the film, the only other things that sort of I picked out as I was watching it is, one, I'm not sure how good their sensation of pain is, because they seem to get hurt a lot. Stumpy in the first film continues to use the stump without any sort of clear sign. Like, it's not like he's favoring it or holding away from it. He's still banging Stumpy it against things. Stumpy being
the grab, whose tentacle was ripped out when it tried to stop Val and Earl's truck, Kevin Bacon's truck, and it gets caught around the axle and they rip it right out, which just sounds incredibly painful.
Awfully painful. And the other thing is, when it's getting shot, it doesn't seem to really be pulling away. Like, it's vocalizing as it's getting shot in that basement, but it's not attempting to retreat. It's still sort of moving, thrashing back and forth. It doesn't seem to be sort of completely understanding where the damage is coming from. So I'm not sure how good their sense of pain is, and that actually could be, we'll talk about that as an evolutionary thing. And then the other thing is, I thought they seemed to be pretty intelligent in terms of they're capable of obviously communicating, working together, of setting traps, of waiting, and basically waiting out the humans outside of everything. So in terms of moving through the systems, as we've sort of discussed, I'm going to try to focus on three systems that I find are really interesting, but I'm going to touch on the other systems rather quickly, just so that we sort of get an idea as to how these things would work. So in terms of comparable animals, the three that I sort of decided to focus on, well, four for this discussion, were the earthworms, because they also live underground, snakes, because they move in a way that I think is probably going to be useful to us here, and cuttlefish, because that's apparently one of the species they suggested that they're sort of originally composed from. So cuttlefish sort of having a hard, brittle internal structure, a different shell-like, being not a fish at all, but a cephalopod, roaming around in the ocean. They don't tend to go all that deep, and having a really cool ambush predator basis where basically they come up on their prey living in the dirt and the mud directly below, kind of spray air at them to try and scare them and get them to move, and then jump on them and eat them. Yes, and very bright. And with so in terms of the first thing as we start every week is calculating out the total mass of our graboid. And I know that they've given us, they think that they're, you know, 10 to 20, or sorry, around 20 tons being the weight of the graboid. That's frankly not going to work for our discussion. They're far too heavy. They can't move through dirt if they weigh that much. Yeah. They're going to be moving along incredibly slow. So I kind of looked at a couple of other comparable species, because the thing is we need to get them up to speed. So looking at what would happen if I just took a traditional black mamba snake and kind of scaled it up, or ended up taking a rhinoceros and kind of scaling it down, and looking at the fact that they seem to be capable of holding a truck in place, right, when they're underground in terms of a comparable weight, I'm happier placing their weight around 5,000 pounds or 2.5 tons. I think that's as big as I can see the worms getting and still being able to move through the dirt. And I'm pretty sure still at that point, they're going to be too heavy. Okay. They seem to have a hard, leathery skin. I picked up a couple of pictures from the film, and I ended up feeling they were much closer to that scene with a rhinoceros than they were a snake. Because there's a couple points, like in the second one, they refer to them as reptilian. They're not reptilian. The skin looks dense and thick. Probably comparable to a rhino, sort of around the 2 to 5 centimeter range. And this fits better with the cuttlefish, because cuttlefish have more traditional skin, sort of with a dermis and an epidermis. I do like the idea of them having spikes all over them. Worms move using a set of small hairs attached to them called setae, and they connect their setae onto their circular segments, and they've got around 100 circular segments and about 8 of these sort of setae per segment. And that allows them to move through. So I did like the spikes. They probably are using those to try and move, and they're probably raising and collapsing them using some sort of muscular system. But they'd need a lot more than are seen in the film, like a lot more. And then in terms of the beak, it looks to be a cephalopod beak. So it's going to be just composed of chitin, falling into the normal range of having sort of an upper and a lower part. And that should give them a fairly stiff material to try and help them burrow through the dirt with. Contrary to one of the films where they say, hey, the beak is made of magnesium. I don't think it's made of magnesium.
That being Tremors 5, Bloodlines.
And it's worth mentioning that that all kind of mollusks have a mantle or a shell. Most of them are internal, some of them are external. But they've evolved into so many different cool forms and that sort of thing. That, I mean, it's totally reasonable for a mantle to have evolved into something that, yeah, that, like, supports them internally and helps them grow through the dirt.
So I think their mantle is internally. So just the... And last point about the skin, just being it has been thickened to try and help with... And you guys will probably get into this more. I think water retention. The fact that they're out in a desert environment, so the skin is thick, it often offers protection, but also allows them to sort of conserve water. Now, the skeleton. This was kind of one of the coolest parts, because cuttlefish do have an internal skeleton. it's sort of more of an internal, it's called cuttle bone, and it's composed of a substance called aragonite. And aragonite is just a way that you bond calcium and carbonate together into a different pattern, different than what we use. Now, really cool, and do you want me to talk about why we don't think there's anything in the fossil record using this bone? Is that okay?
Yeah,
you get into, because that's the physiology, the evolution of the skeleton. Yeah.
Perfect. So we kind of racked our brains, and we were discussing back and forth, how exactly would they be able to not have anything in the fossil record, which keeps getting brought over, other than these spikes that they keep sort of bringing out. And I think the spikes are probably made of a hard keratin, similar to what makes up a rhino nose or a pangolin scale, in terms of what they've used to sort of make the substance. But their bones themselves, if they are composed of aragonite, similar to what we see within other creatures, then it doesn't fossilize well. I found a couple papers discussing the fact that we're missing a lot of records associated with cuttlefish and with other sort of cephalopods, that if you build your skeleton out of this substance, it doesn't tend to take in the minerals very well associated with the fossilization process. And as a result, that could explain why we don't have anything in the fossil record. Now, I think that their skeleton has changed as they've basically evolved to live on land. And I think it's more like a snake at this point. So they've got multiple vertebrae all the way along, kind of connecting to muscular layers on the outside and connecting to the spikes. And we'll sort of get into what that's going to allow them to do in the muscle section. But I also think that they've probably kept the fact that aragonite is sort of, it's chambered, it's gas-filled, and it's used by the cuttlefish for buoyancy control. And I think that having some extra air in their bones is going to help them basically pneumatize their bones, keep their weight down, and is going to kind of assist them with moving through the soil as rapidly as they move through. Cardiovascular, I had to explain why they have orange blood. I went reading through, so cuttlefish actually kind of have a greenish blue blood, and it's based on the fact that they've got a copper containing blood, something called hemocyanin. I don't think that's going to work for them on land. I think that they are going to have evolved to use hemoglobin like us. But really cool, the only thing in nature that produces orange blood are bad bacterial infections. Or Trichomonas, which is a parasite. It produces sort of an orange tinge to your blood, and we know that the graboids absolutely smell terrible. I think they've got a bunch of persistent infections. I think that traveling through the soil, that they have sort of accumulated these bacterial or parasitic infections, or the other thing might be if the shriekers are a parasite growing inside of them, that's constantly there and might be draining their energy, because we know that the shriekers kind of explode out of them and everything like that. It might be causing an effect that causes both a terrible smell, because you've got decomposing sort of infection, along with an orangish hue.
Okay, interesting.
Blood.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. The only thing I could find that was turning it was trichomosis, or a bacterial infection, most evident with bacterial vaginitis. Turns it orange and creates a horrible smell.
It's really
that
gross.
Is gross, yeah. Although their constant infections could work well with what Adam and me are going to talk about later in terms of deleterious inbreeding and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay.
But maybe. So we can get into that a bit later.
Okay, so one of the cool things that I want to take a little bit longer to focus on is the musculoskeletal system and how these guys move and basically go underground. So they can't move like a worm. I'm sure there is a listener that's like, ooh, well, you know, maybe they're going to move like a worm. Worms move incredibly slow. They move 73 meters per hour. That's not going to add up with what we need them to do, even if we scale them up. And the way that they move is they kind of extend and contract their body using these little circular muscles on the side and using their setae to kind of link them in the ground as they go. And this whole stretching and collapsing, it's not going to work if they've got really dense skin. It's not going to work for the kind of skeleton that we're wanting them to build. So instead, I think they move more similar to a snake. And basically doing what's called an S-shaped or serpentine movement. And having this S-shaped pattern by which basically they move under the ground going across. And I think that these spikes sort of come up and go down, come up and go down, allowing them to grip onto the soil. Now, I don't think they're going to be able to do that 15 to 20 miles per hour. I think that movement through the dirt, that with the loose dirt, as long as they're traveling close to the surface and they're kind of burrowing back and forth, I think they might be able to shift it away from themselves-ish, depending on what they're moving through. But I think their speed going through it is going to be much more limited. I mean, the black mamba is the world's fastest snake, and working on the land and moving along at quite a beat, its top speed is 12 miles per hour. So I'm thinking our worms are probably going to move a lot slower, kind of in the 5, maybe 10 mile per hour range. And this is still going to kind of work for them because the an average human being ends up moving around at around 10 to 15 miles per hour. So theoretically, if they're sneaking up on them or they're catching them off guard, but like, I'm not convinced that Kevin Bacon and his crew wouldn't have just been able to basically outrun the graboids on the land. They wouldn't have had to get a vehicle. They could have just fled into the direction. I think the only other modification, and they talked about this a couple of times in the films, is in Tremors 5, one of the scientists walking by says, oh, well, you know, they shoot out acid to try and degrade the earth around them, and they've got a beak made of magnesium. They can't shoot out acid. You can't shoot out acid. It's super energetically costly, and you'd have to cover yourself in mucus at all times to protect yourself from the acid that you're basically... You'd be dumping acid on yourself. You can't shoot out acid. The only thing that they might be able to do is cuttlefish, when they're bringing up shrimp or crabs, kind of shoot out they shoot out a jet of air to try and like disturb the soil and get the crab and the shrimp to come to the surface. They might be able to shoot out a stream of the air in front of themselves to try and help break up the dirt and loosen it as they move through.
Mm-hmm.
But to do that, they would have to be constantly breathing in a way they have to be pulling air in. And that fits, because I think the graboids have blowholes. So, a whale.
Okay.
So I think that they might be able to do this. I'm not sure how much it would help them, but it might be a way to try and like loosen the material in front of them. And they are going to move fastest through very dry earth. Everybody seems to think that worms move fastest, like, if it's wet. They don't. They drown. They like moist earth because they have to breathe through their skin. But the earth has to be dry. The last thing being the mouth appendages in the movement section. They have these sort of prehensile mouths that jump out. They're around 10 feet long. I think, and you guys will get into this, I think they're adaptations from the cuttlefish suckers. So they extend forward, they're prehensile, and the only other thing, because in cuttlefish they actually have a taste by touch sensitivity, which fits because we see like they seem to be able to distinguish when the prehensile bits are out in terms of figuring out what is edible and what is not and what they can drag under. And in the second Tremors with the Shriekers, that point is made. They go, oh, they must taste with their tongue. That's how they decide what they can eat, which I think they are here. I think those are the prehensile suckers are allowing them to taste. And the only other thing that I think they might have, I think they might have venom on their tips. Okay.
Some kind of paralyzing neurotoxin? Because
cuttlefish... so the cuttlefish sucker actually has venom attached to the end of it. And I was watching the films over again, and I think it's just bad acting, but in this we can explain that they might actually be paralyzing their prey, which is why nobody seems to struggle all that much when they get stuck by one of these suckers.
Oh, to be fair, in the first episode, when Bert gets grabbed in the rec room,
yeah,
and then he gets pulled along a little bit, and he's fine after that.
He is, but the sucker actually never grabs his foot. It doesn't go, like, it wraps around him. But we see other characters where, like, the prehensile mouth comes up and bites them, like, on the shoulder or bites them on the leg, and then they go, like, ah! And then they seem to go limp and they get dragged away. And again, I think it's just bad acting because one of the directors came over and was like, if you move and break this prop, you're done.
It's definitely
because of how expensive it was.
Production value on the movie itself.
right. Yeah. But I think it'd be kind of cool if they kept that evolutionary trait of the cuttlefish and continued to keep sort of venom within these.
Okay, yeah.
Respiratory, I think they got lungs like us or like snakes. I don't think they're going to be like a worm. They can't breathe through their skin. But really cool, I was watching the film over, and every time that the tremors come to the surface, we see this big spurt of dirt. It's kind of the way that everybody knows that the tremors are coming, right? They come up, and you can see the spurt of dirt, and in one of the Tremors movies, it's actually how this con man uses, he uses a canister with dirt to try and convince people that the tremors are coming on this, like, fake ride that he's designed to get people to come out into the desert, and he's like, oh, look, a graboid is coming, and, like, scares people by having these spurts of dirt in the air. I think the Tremors have, I think the graboids have blowholes. I think that they regularly sort of surface, and when they get close to the surface, they use this basically blowhole to breathe. I think it's independent from their GI or their digestive system.
Gastrointestinal.
And like whales, and like whales, this means that it reduces their risk of blocking their respiratory system when eating large food, which they do. They suck down huge people. It means that they can eat underground without worrying about taking dirt into their lungs. And it also means that they can take oxygen without having to lift their head above the ground, which might be because they can't breathe underground. They're going to suck dirt into their lungs. I think they come to the surface to breathe and to suck in large amounts of air and then burrow. But I think that's also why they travel so close to the surface, such that we can actually see almost like the round part of them moving along. They leave like a dust trail. I think they're traveling along close enough that they can actually breathe.
And they would need to do that a lot because it's so energetically costly to be constantly burrowing through that soil without taking any kind of breath. A whale can do it because they just glide through the water very, very efficiently. They don't take much energy to do it.
Yeah. Neurologically, I think they're really smart, as we discussed, which fits. Cephalopods are a very intelligent member of the species. And cool paper, I ended up finding out octopus and cephalopods don't feel pain like we do. They still hurt. They really, really hurt. But there's some new research out that suggests that when they get injured, they actually feel pain all through their body. And it seems to spread. They actually have a lot of trouble localizing it. They don't know why, but as a result, so that might be why our graboid gets shot and doesn't seem to really react in the same way. They might just be feeling painful all over when they get hurt.
Okay.
Also, I wonder if the tremors, I don't know how you thought of the structure of the brain itself, but at least for some squid, the brain itself actually wraps around the esophagus of a squid. So if they eat too much food at once, they will suffer brain damage from flexing the brain itself. Because their esophagus passes through the ring of their brain.
Cool. No, I didn't know that. I like that. Yeah, so that could fit with them like limiting how much they're eating.
Which they don't seem to do.
Adam will get into this a little bit later, but obviously I think that they lay their eggs like brine shrimp in terms of they've got very long-lasting, very hardy eggs.
Yeah.
And then the final sort of system I'd like to spend a little bit of time on is their vibration and sort of specialized sensory systems.
Yep.
So it took me a while to figure out how worms sense vibration through the dirt. In terms of, I had to dig up a couple of different papers, but worms seem to have these sort of little sensory bumps that are kind of all over themselves, and then they concentrate a lot of those sensory bumps near their head in order to have a mechanism by which they can sort of detect where something is coming from, and then based on the vibration can direct themselves towards it. Now, this is really useful for them when it starts to rain, because the rain on the surface will drown them, and they need to be able to basically sense where the sound is coming from and then move up towards the surface to avoid the rain. Now, really cool side point, a lot of animals have actually evolved the ability to summon worms and fake that they're rain. So there is a species of turtle that will actually sit on the surface and will beat its foot at the same frequency as associated with falling rain.
That fast.
It's so cool. That's so cool that you've actually got a turtle sitting on the surface, and who knows how long they have to do this, but they're beating away on the surface of the dirt to summon up worms to eat. And then having birds that are like pecking at
the
surface.
The birds also kind of dance. They do a little dance on the surface, pounding their little their feet on the ground, and it simulates those raindrops, and the worms will come up and get eaten.
And this works really well from the cuttlefish perspective, because I mean cuttlefish have sensory like hair cells on their surface, which are really sensitive to water movement.
Oh, cool.
So I mean, if we take a similar sort of adaptation, because
we're thinking
that there's a common ancestor here.
Yeah. So
same sort of thing, just works in soil instead of water.
Yeah. So if they took those hairs and then they kind of built them similar to how you and I would build our ears, where basically you've got a little bud that's filled with liquid and you've got cilia inside it, such that when it gets bounced around, it moves and tells you where something is coming from. So I definitely think that they have that. I think they do have some mechanism. Earthworms do have photoreceptors that are built into their tissue to allow them to detect sunlight. I think the tremoy or the graboids are going to have something like that as well, so that they can sort of detect where the light is coming from and sort of surface and bring themselves down so they know when they're exposed. They're going to have some way of knowing. And then the last thing, I think they've got an internal gyroscope.
They would need it.
Similar to what you and I have. Yeah, so we've got a semicircular canal, which is these fluid-filled things that also have cilia in them that help us orient ourselves in space. I think they're going to have something as well, so they know where the surface is to kind of come up and get things. In which snakes have all kinds of other species, and I think the cuttlefish could evolve something similar as well. But the last thing, I was rewatching the films a couple nights ago, the tongues that they sort of send out seem to have little antennae almost attached to the top of them, like they've got these long pieces sticking up. I think it might be cool if they used those as well, like insects. Their chete, their vibration sensors, are located on their antennae, so they can basically feel vibrations in the air, which allows them to hunt when they're much closer. I'm wondering if the prehensile tongues haven't adapted something similar, which is why they pull those out and then they go searching for the prey, and they seem to be able to detect when people are yelling or when they're moving around, because they might just be basically feeling out the changes in the air frequency, or the changes in the air, to try and move closer to whatever it is they're trying to hunt.
Yeah, so cephalopods have contact receptors in their tentacles and their sucker rims and their lips. They can sense a really broad spectrum of chemical and mechanical signals. Yeah.
So I think that all fits. I don't think, just as a negative, I don't think they're going to be super strong, our graboids. I don't think that you can put the kind of weight to like drag a car underneath. And I'm not quite sure how you would do it, because a car doesn't really go into the dirt.
I was more under the impression that they use the tentacles to position the car and then they destabilize the soil directly
like
below something.
Maybe. So basically trying to create like a sinkhole, like shifting themselves backwards.
Exactly,
maybe.
Yeah.
That could be something. It's going to be really difficult, because obviously a car isn't really aerodynamic or hydrodynamic. It doesn't really have the shape to burrow in the same way that the graboids might. And again, I mean, maybe they're super strong if their weight is on the closer to sort of 3 tons range. But if their weight is sort of lowered down, I'm not sure that they're going to... They'll definitely be able to come up and eat humans and do all that. I'm just not sure that they'll be able to hold a car or sink a car. All right, and I think that is the physiology section.
Awesome. Well done, Dave.
I feel I was denied critical need-to-know information.
Alrighty, well, yeah, well done, Dave. Cutting it down. That was bloody great.
All right, good.
Yeah, so, Adam, where are we starting? Evolution in life, evolutionary history, yeah, so. Right? Yeah, so the first thing was that we actually had like a taxonomic classification that was given by, like a fact sheet from Sci-Fi, right?
Promotional material, because these were, as we had talked about earlier, all like direct-to-video movies. And Sci-Fi, at least historically in the U.S., back in the late 90s, early 2000s, just their bread and butter were these kind of like cheaply produced horror monster movies. And so what they kind of did to like release factoids, have like a website, be like, you know, oh, the binomial name, you know, for the graboid is the Keteris Americana, and then the Shrieker is Keteris Mexicana, because, you know, they're in Mexico. And then the S-Blaster, Keteris Mexicana Combustus. And they put them in the Sepioida order, which is the cuttlefish, right? And they made up a fictional family called Vermiformidae, which just means worm-shaped.
Yeah. Now, that's I really like that for a family name. However, Adam and I were talking about this before. So I think the earliest record of like a graboid type kind of spike was from dated as being 400 million years old. About 400 million years, right?
Yeah.
So the cuttlefish order didn't evolve. They didn't appear until like the Cretaceous period, which I think started 180, 175 million years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think that the graboids can possibly share an order with the cuttlefish. I think it has to be, you know, another branch. I'm happy for them to be cephalopods because that works really well, and I'm happy for them to like that order to be the closest order possible to the Sepioidae. So the cuttlefish, but I don't think they can be that closely related. Having said that, from an evolutionary point of view, like I don't want to say it makes perfect sense, but it makes the most sense. Like, you have these tentacles that we're talking about that kind of match the cuttlefish tentacle receptors and octopus tentacle receptors. Cuttlefish and octopus have kind of distributed intelligence, so they have systems that are kind of similar to ours. But whereas all our thinky bits are concentrated in our brain, it's the intelligence is distributed throughout the body in a lot of these creatures.
Yeah.
So, for instance, and I want to say thank you to the True Facts online videos for this. Like, if you cut off an octopus's arm, in several species, it will continue to try and bring food back to a mouth. That sort of thing.
Yeah, we talk about this common ancestor kind of goes back to our first episode with Kong, where you have, we talked about the whales and how they're descended from these wolf-like ancestors, where originally the blowhole used to be a nose, and it just, over time, it moved further and further and further back the skull until it was on top, and then that's where you could have an organism that's able to swim through the water with the blowhole on top. So it, like Sam was saying, it makes sense, quote-unquote, that you had this cuttlefish-like ancestor that migrated somehow towards land, and these tentacles went from being attached to the face itself to kind of moving inside of the mouth and still serving as tentacles and appendages, but they now can retract fully inside of this beak-like structure.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you have tentacles outside of the mouth, that's not a real good strategy because they're constantly exposed to things that can hurt them. They need to be able to withdraw those tentacles into a safe place. And I mean, we think that maybe they kind of, you know, were cuttlefish that cephalopods, I should say, that were existing in kind of marshy areas. So they started burrowing into soil and living kind of the opposite of what whales did, where whales were just kind of, when they first started to evolve, they were spending some time in the water, but not all their time in the water. And then they kind of moved in there to, you know, find prey or whatever. So these cephalopods, early cephalopods, would have just gone the other way around, spending time in like in mud banks and that sort of stuff, and then moving further and further in until they were completely land-based.
Yeah, once again,
as a side note,
I
just realized that you guys would be probably one of the worst uses of a time machine, because both of you would just go back and you would just like sit down with a bag of popcorn and watch things evolve and be like, we knew it!
Oh,
we knew it! That's what it did! Let's go back, let's see which stage they're at. Oh, okay.
That's all I'd do. Like, if I had a TARDIS, I'd just be sitting there like, you know, jumping like 20 million years in advance watching the same organism go.
I'd be
bloody fantastic.
I'd be going on sexy adventures with Jack Harkness, but that's a separate story. But with
Yeah, for people who don't know, Adam basically is Jack Harkness without a time machine.
Yeah.
Oh, that is the best thing you've ever said to me. But yeah.
I thought the best thing I'd ever said to you was, I love the Rocky Horror soundtrack.
That too. That, I mean, that just gets me aroused, but that's a separate thing. But talking about the, going back to the evolution, we cannot stress enough that evolution is not a directed process. This is not something you can actually watch. Yeah. There's no goal in evolution. It's just whatever works best is going to work. So what happened in this, in our fictional timeline, is you have this common ancestor that is most likely a marine organism living in the oceans, and some of them have some kind of weird adaptation or a mutation where they start to go onto the shore, onto these, like, you know, maybe a mud bank of a river, of an estuary, something. And eventually, over time, they get more and more adaptations that allow them to go further and further and further into the soil, more away from their you know, their ancestral water habitat, so they can be more adapted to this drier environment, and eventually you get modern day quote unquote graboids.
Yeah. And that and Dave was also talking about how they evolve lungs and a skeleton now. This is a great example of convergent evolution. And the neural system of a cephalopod has evolved completely differently from ours, but they work in similar ways. That's a great example of convergent evolution, where two things have evolved completely separately, but they're quite similar because, you know, they fulfill the same basic requirement. So when Dave was saying, you know, they'll have lungs and the skeleton and vertebrae and that sort of things, we're thinking they've evolved the same way as the brains have, vertebrate brains and cephalopod brains. They wouldn't resemble each other, but there's a degree of similarity there, and they've taken different evolutionary timelines, but they fulfill basically the same purpose.
Right, and when I say that, they're probably going to end up with a lung structure similar to what we see with something like our terrestrial crab, where it's not necessarily like a mammalian lung, it's like a modification of the gill structure to give themselves kind of like an internal lung, basically, that they're using, which we see in a lot of aquatic species that gain some form of terrestrial adaptation. And we're also, when we're talking about the skeleton, it's not going to be exactly like a snake. It's going to be similar in terms of the breakdown, but there's probably going to be a lot of architectural differences.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that takes us through the majority of the evolutionary history. I guess they've lost their eyes because they don't really need them that much. They rely on, like I said, kind of sensory ciliae or hairs or chitae to sense vibrations in the earth.
And eyes are going to be a problem underground for them terms of, you're going to have to either have a mechanism of keeping them closed, or you're going to have gunk getting into them. They don't make sense to keep if you evolve in that direction.
And they're an incredibly costly organ to develop and maintain energetically and evolutionarily speaking.
Yes.
Yes.
There's a lot of effort going
into
an eyeball.
Cool side point, goldfish, when they survive under the water when everything freezes over during the winter time, one of the mechanisms that they do to survive is, one, they end up producing ethanol to stop the water from freezing around them, but two, to try and save energy, they actually turn off their eyeballs. In terms of they shut down the energy to their eyes, and then they also shut down the part of the brain associated with visualization, because it takes that much energy to maintain.
I should turn off my balls every time I looked at Sam.
Hey!
Got a weekly Sam day.
Yeah, we haven't had a... Oh, so Sam.
Once a week.
Gotta have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then touching briefly on... So,
all right.
We have... Originally, they're endemic only to this small valley, this Box Canyon in Nevada, in southern Nevada. But then Tremors 2 is in Mexico, 3 is also, I believe, in Mexico, 4 is back in Nevada, in Rejection, Nevada, later on, Perfection.
3 is back in Nevada.
3 is in Nevada. 3 is
back,
okay, in, 3 Perfection. Is back in
Nevada. It's literally called Back to Perfection, Adam.
I'm sorry. I'll take that. That's me.
Yeah, well, maybe they were talking about the evolutionary perfection of the Graboids.
Yeah, you idiot. Dave.
Yeah.
But then 5 is set in South Africa. And then 6 is up in none of it, in northern Canada. Yeah. So how these organisms got there is a bit of a question, but since they are, about evolutionary speaking, 400 million years old, it's possible that they were once in one area, or at least they were in a much more suitable habitat, spread out over the massive supercontinent of Pangaea. And Sam, I know you're saying that Gondwana was after Pangaea. Pangaea. Everything that I'm seeing is saying that Gondwana was formed after Pangaea, whatever you want to call it, broke up. So they could have been in one location. the continent eventually split into the separate continents we have today, so that it makes sense they could have been in, gotten from South Africa to Northern Canada to Nevada. That's where you have fossil records matching up from the eastern coast of South America and the western coast of Africa. They used to be together. It was a similar habitat. It broke up.
Africa and South America were part of West Gondwana. Gondwana broke into two, I think, about 320 million years ago. So it makes sense that you'd have them in Africa and South America, and then they can potentially migrate into what then became North America. But I have no problem with them being in South Africa, because you've got plenty of desert out there. I have no problem with them being in Mexico and Nevada, but none of it makes no sense.
Absolutely.
You're having none of it?
I am having absolutely fucking none of it.
So what Sam means to say is them being in Northern Canada makes absolutely no sense. We can talk on that a little bit later when we get to the end of the reproduction as how that might have happened, but it's definitely a huge fluke.
This I think was the biggest thing that Adam and I ran into. The fact that they have these ranges that must be so expansive, because I mean there is so much desert in the world.
Yes.
Not leaving the Sahara alone. Let's just say there's something to do with the Sahara that gives them
too hot.
Let's just leave places like the Sahara, like the Gobi Desert alone. And look at their restricted territory in the USA. The USA has massive amounts of that, like, kind of sandy desert. These creatures should be able to inhabit. So the problem we faced was, how do we explain how restricted their population range is? Because it's worth saying that just because certain parts of the world are suitable for a creature doesn't mean they're going to be found there. They're potentially not going to be able to migrate there, or they're going to have competitors that drive them out. For instance, squirrels never really took in Australia, even though we tried to introduce them.
Really?
Because possums just had that niche on lock. They weren't being fucked with. And, you know, likewise, marsupials. Most marsupials haven't been able to colonize anywhere outside of Australia. Although there are some extant populations of... No, because there's some bloody... there's some extant populations of wallabies on in some of the British Isles, like some of the little islands off the coast of England. Yeah. Wallaby populations. You can look them up. Look up wallaby populations, British Isles. You can find a few of them. Yeah. But, what we ended up theorizing was that... with the mechanization of America, the industrial age being brought to America, you had, you know, huge kind of plants going on, like oil drilling, that sort of thing. And whilst, you know, tremors are great for them to, you know, sense their prey, if you have something that's too large, it's either they're either going to see it as a threat, or that amount of vibration and movement could just throw their senses off completely and they need to get the fuck out of there.
Could also be painful.
Now this, this might have explained, we were still kind of in a bit of trouble here, because I mean there's so many small towns out in America that would not, you know, would have much smaller populations. So, and you know, people are always crossing, crossing between towns, that sort of thing. And so we theorized that perhaps the construction of train lines running across the USA really restricted the ranges of these creatures, because they, you know, they knew that train lines, they saw them as a threat. Yeah, it was either, you know, caused them pain, or they viewed it as, you know, like I said, a threat to their livelihood. And
like
so that really restricted their distribution range a lot. But it still doesn't explain why in certain pockets they didn't persist that well. Now, if you have something like a metapopulation, and you restrict connectivity between different populations, that can really reduce the viability of that entire meta population. So a meta population is a series of different populations that have like emigration and immigration between them all. And if you reduce that immigration and emigration, what you create is kind of, just a bunch of smaller isolated populations, which then will have problems with things like inbreeding. If there's increased mortality there because they've got no immigration, they've got nothing to replace that. And Adam and I theorized that this is why a lot of those populations have since gone extinct, because the habitat was too heavily fragmented.
Yeah.
But tying that into you know, the westward expansion of the 19th century United States, kind of, it's a fun little retcon of the anecdotal history of, so a lot of people died building those railroads that Sam was just talking about, and obviously we know this is because of terrible work conditions, unforgivable environmental conditions, but keeping them working all day, not caring for the workers. But before those railways got it,
but what if graboids? Yeah, am what if I graboids right?
did it all before the railways were built? Also, this is around that time that industrialization was happening, or at least a little bit beforehand. You had the Oregon Trail going on in the United States, where you had an estimated 300,000 pioneers going from what was then the westernmost state, Missouri, over to California, Oregon, modern-day Washington. And an estimated 5% of those migrants died on the trail, which means about 15,000. So who knows how many of those were actually due to graboid attacks as they made their way west.
And there's also one thing that really could have... So, for instance, with populations, like mid-sized populations in America, you often find that they have kind of a north-to-south distribution, because throughout America, you have these enormous, like, north-to-south fragments.
Barriers.
Population boundaries dispersal barriers in
America. Sam, are you saying you feel like there's a fragmentation between the north and the south in the United States?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying populations run north to south because the dispersal barriers run north to south.
Yeah,
so the fragmentation is actually between the east and the west. Yeah, because you've got this enormous, like, you've got the Rockies down there, you've got these huge mountain ranges. So that would have already fragmented the population into this kind of corridor. What do you guys call it? You call it the...
The Great Plains.
Yeah, the Great Plains, this kind of corridor running north to south. And then if you have a bunch of train lines coming and running east to west, you further fragment a population, and it works like it would have shut everything down. And we think the fact that they're only still around now is because I think these eggs that they lay can...
Lie dormant for a long time. So that little press release is saying the eggs can lie dormant for 300-something years, which, excuse me, if that is the case, and we can make that work, if we can make that work physiologically...
Yeah, we can make that work.
We can make that work. Awesome. So it makes sense that not many people have heard of these guys. This was a time long before the internet, even before, like, reliable stories. So you always have these frontier stories of, like, you know, I saw a grizzly bear that was 5 meters tall, or, you know, it was the natives, and there was
Sam.
Six, it looked like Sam was terrible. Sam, I wish I turned my eyes off. Callback.
I mean, the worms do look a lot like you. I was
they
wondering
do not.
If White. Had not
I don't have anywhere near that many tentacles.
If only. A man can dream.
Yeah.
I mean, the smell being produced by them. I was watching it. I'm like, I don't think I've ever run into anything this wretched. And then I was like, oh, no, wait. I lived with Sam. Right.
I never had to live with him. But, you know, spent enough time with him in a couple of different countries. But you have these. Yeah. So.
You're a butt.
I have a great butt. So you have these organisms that have never really been seen before 1990, and when they're seen in Perfection, Nevada, but they could have been seen, they would not have been believed, and it would have been incredibly uncommon to have seen them if their population had been fragmented that much by that time. So as far as behavioral ecology, that makes sense. Now, getting into how they could have possibly diverse in this complex life cycle they have, we're going to briefly go into that, because in Tremors, the first one, we only have the graboids, which is the first stage of their life cycle. So what happens is a graboid eats a lot, and eventually it will crawl up onto the surface, knowing it's about to die, and anywhere from 3 to 6 of these shriekers, these little bipedal, armless, thermal vision-having creatures, rip out of them. And these are the second stage, and they're basically like a walking cocoon, because after a period of a few days, I want to say, after they've eaten enough, they shed that skin. They're now a slightly leaner, fiercer, winged ass blaster, which is the final stage of their life cycle. These organisms can then use their combustible anuses to take off, fly a distance. You know, they could do this many, many times and get pretty far.
Combustible asses.
I said anus. I'm a scientist. And then they lay eggs. So... This makes sense. You have the final stage having not only the reproductive ability, but the dispersal ability to get away from its source population, which is what you want to do, because otherwise you have inbreeding depressions where you have organisms that are very related to one another breeding all the time, and then you get things like Sam. It's just horrible. and...
Horrible. That's not related to inbreeding, though. That's just, you know, poor genes.
Now, you're going to get into the mechanism by which we think the eggs are long-lived, or do you want me to touch on the sort of brine shrimp idea?
Touch that, please.
No, I don't think we need to go into that too much. I mean, you talked about that a bit last week, right?
We did. But I was talking about this a little bit last night, and I think one of the ways. So I think, yeah, similar to a brine shrimp, they're going to create these dehydrated eggs. But I think that they're potentially going to be getting a lot of their water from metabolic sources. So from eating whatever they're eating out in the wild.
Yeah.
And I think similar to a snake, they could have, so snakes have an adaptation where if they haven't eaten for a while, they actually start to pull water away from their intestines and start to shrivel everything up to conserve water and also to not waste that metabolic or energy process.
Yeah.
Now, there is some evidence to suggest they might be able to do that for their reproductive systems as well. So I wonder if food is becoming less scarce and you're becoming more dehydrated. You're becoming... more dehydrated in terms of you've got less access to water, then theoretically the eggs that you're going to be laying are going to be more and more dehydrated. So if you're in a period of scarcity where you've got less food, that means you're also going to have less water, which means the eggs you're going to be producing are more dehydrated and might lay dormant for longer periods of time.
Yeah. And lots of animals have that mechanism whereby they can sense that there's less resources around, and they may terminate a reproductive cycle, or they may alter the reproductive cycle. And in this case, I think that's what they do. They alter the reproductive cycle, so they lay eggs which go dormant until, I don't know, maybe there's more precipitation in the soil around them, or soil chemistry changes. Or in this case, we think they were just potentially disturbed by nearby drilling activity.
Yeah, maybe. And so in the later films, whenever you do see these eggs or these clusters of graboid or shriekers and ass blasters, these eggs seem to exclusively end up in caves or these cave systems. So what I think happens is as these ass blasters are dispersing, as they're gliding over the landscape, they're using their thermal vision to kind of pick out these cooler spots that might indicate a depression in the earth or a cave of some kind. They go to the cave, they lay their eggs, and they take off, they go somewhere else. And then what might happen is, in the desert, it doesn't rain very often, but when it does, it rains a lot. And that would flood a cave, hydrate the eggs, eggs hatch, graboids go, and the cycle starts all over again.
So maybe opening the caves then introduces more ambient moisture in the air, or some of the drilling has just accidentally introduced water. If like a couple of the guys out drilling in the first, tremors may have dumped a couple of their beers or dumped some water accidentally into one of these areas, they might have activated some of them.
Okay,
so the last thing we should touch on very quickly is the fact that their predatory behavior is very, very complex. The fact that they can almost set traps, coordinated attacks. Sinking the building, that sort of thing. Going back to the cuttlefish and what cephalopods can do. Cuttlefish are semi-social species. Octopus are very solitary, but squids are very social species. They sometimes occur in schools. Cuttlefish are semi-social. But they're all capable of very coordinated attacks.
Cephalopods, like the octopi, like squid, like cuttlefish, they pass the dot test with a mirror, which is where you present an organism. With a mirror. They recognize it not as a different animal, but they recognize it as a reflection of themselves, because they have a dot. They put a dot on the organism. And the organism doesn't try to touch the dot on the organism. They touch the dot on themselves using the mirror. So they recognize it as a reflection of themselves. And only very, very intelligent animals are able to do this, like some crow species, like corvids, cephalopods, chimpanzees, and obviously humans can.
Now, here we go. I've got the paper in here from last year by Roger Villanueva, which basically says that cephalopods are capable of ambushes, luring, stalking, pursuit, speculative hunting, and even hunting in disguise. So all that sort of activity we see them doing in the first film is, totally believable. as believable as this is going
to
be.
A giant monster moving through the dirt is.
So yep. Really believable.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, you see learning behavior. You see them trying to bring the building down because they know that's not prey. I even think that that early on when they sort of detect that the car is a vehicle in motion that potentially contains prey.
Yeah.
They can then, you know, find the cars and disable the cars as a way for them to, you know, trap prey.
Yeah, and they don't seem to attack the cars. It's... And for all the later films, and this is most obvious in the most recent one, 6, the one in None of It, they have a character tries to run to the car, he makes it, and the one character is imploring him not to start it, because as soon as he starts it, the Graboid recognizes it as what it is, you know, some kind of transport, and slams into it, kills the guy, and eats him.
I still absolutely love the idea of these things hunting the pioneers back in the day, in an age where, like, if you wandered off to take a pee, the Graboid gets you, and we don't investigate, right? It's not like where I go out and I'm like, what happened to Sam, or like, what got him? It's just simply I walk over, I see Sam's, like, canteen on the ground, and I'm just like, Sam's gone. Like, something got him. I don't know what it is. Could have been a bear, could have been a coyote, could have been a Graboid. I don't know. Sam's gone. And then you just move on with your day.
Knock itself cold.
Cold my ass. He's dead. Well, he killed him. We killed it. Fuck you!
Dave, have you got a versus for us this week?
I think I do. So in the spirit of my everlasting love for Kevin Bacon, I want to propose Kevin Bacon in his best role of all time, Footloose, versus the Graboid. And whether or not we think that he could dance in any way, shape, or form to try and, you know, get that Graboid to go away. And whether or not we think that his amazing dancing, flipping, and fantastic skills would allow him to actually avoid getting eaten.
Now, we know that all the vibrations from his amazing gyrations and dancing and footwork is just going to draw all the Graboids in. But the real question is, can he get them to party?
And can he flip over them as Ren McCormick's number
one move is? I think he could definitely flip over them, but as we can see from the later movies, the Graboids are able to fly out of the dirt and catch organisms in the air.
Yeah, there's clips of Graboids like fucking diving out like, you know, like kind of whales do. Jump. when they break. I think he's fucked. I think he's gonna be like, you know,
he's halfway through his dance scene in the barn as he sort of comes in along his jump and he makes the jump down onto the solid ground directly below with arms out, and the Graboid just comes out, grabs him, and then goes back into the soil.
And that.
I think this is a vibration based version of that like fight between Indiana Jones and the dude with the swords. Shoot. Like he's doing this really elaborate thing. And in this case, you know, we've just got the and then the Graboid's just like, fuck this, like just out of midair takes him. I say that partly because I think it's what's going to happen, and partly because in the semifinals that will be coming up soon. Well, not semifinals, but in, you know, The next cutoff. I want to see the Quiet Places versus the Graboids.
That'll be interesting.
Quiet Place versus the Graboids. I want to have that discussion, you know?
In Sam's version, you're saying the local minister in Footloose, the one that's trying to stop everybody from dancing because he feels that it's the devil's
work, is
not actually trying to stop people from dancing. He is well aware of the fact that they've got Graboids. And he is trying to convince the people not to dance for
their
own
safety. But he can't tell them because they'll call him crazy.
He's the hero of that story. Yeah.
I like that a lot.
All right, so we're giving it to the Graboid this week.
All right, Sam, what you got for us next time?
Well, Adam, I hope you're going to love this. I hope you've seen this one. We are doing the Trolls from The Troll Hunter.
Yes!
I think what you mean is the Trolls!
I really want to do this because in this case, like, obviously we're going to have to give Dave one or two in particular. Well, I mean, older trolls and younger trolls to look at, but it gives us a chance to dive into kind of community ecology and like speciation and that sort of thing. I'm really looking forward to this
one. And it's not like Norway likes its trolls or anything like that.
No, not at all. They don't have an unhealthy obsession.
And Sam,
you can't go to gift shops and find like paintings of trolls fucking. That's not something
you can
find.
Can you send me one of those?
I don't have that on an apron.
Chris, Christmas is coming up.
Oh, yeah, some troll porn. I mean,
Sam, yeah. as a current resident of Norway and beast of a person, he is obviously the resident troll of the podcast, so this is good.
And we are well aware of the fact that Sam's Norwegian girlfriend looked at him and she was like, this is... I found one in the wild.
This is perfect.
I've convinced my stepson that I'm actually half troll. No, that I'm a quarter troll and my dad's half troll. Yeah. I was very quickly told by my girlfriend to not do that, as my stepson is terrified of trolls.
They should be. They're horrible creatures.
All right. Thanks again, guys, to everybody. Thanks again to everybody who joined in this week. Thanks once again to Patrick Duthie at patrickduthie.com for putting together our logo. Thanks again to Katie Heath for helping us come up with the name Cinematic Animalia. Thanks to my colleague Andre Ofstad, who again sat down with me this week and went through some of the more viable aspects of graboid population ecology.
Well, we have...
Anybody else you guys want to thank?
Everyone, just for any of the listeners that have been telling your friends and your family, anybody you think was going to enjoy this nerdy science monster shit we're doing. If you have any questions or suggestions for monsters you would love to see us break down, we have an email at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com, spelled just like it is in the podcast title. We also have a website that we'll have up and running soon, hopefully by the time this podcast comes out.
Yeah, we're hoping to have that up.
Full of all kinds of fun facts for the monsters we've broken down so far. At this point, I believe we had all of these episodes banked, but from now on, we'll be releasing them every other week on a fortnightly schedule. Yep. And if you enjoy the show, especially if you're listening to this on iTunes, please give us a 5-star rating if you think we deserved it. Put some reviews in, because that's going to really, really help us as far as being a new podcast and getting more listeners in.
Yeah, and you can find us on Twitter at @C_Animalia. You can email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. Keep it up with the reviews. Tell your friends. If you've got a monster request, we'd love to hear it. We've had some interesting ones so far. I've had a request for Pikachu this week.
Really?
Which,
Who sent you a request for Pikachu?
A friend.
You have friends?
Okay.
Yeah. But, I have friends. I have friends outside of YouTube.
I don't believe it.
I mean, I hope. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
There we go.
All right, see you guys.